Yeah, going back.
We call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum, and our apologies to the public for starting a few minutes late here, but we all just hustled back from the floor because we had sessions. Some of us took stairs and made it faster than others, like me, who took the elevator. Slowed me down a little bit. So before we get started on our bills today, do we have anybody willing to move the minutes for February 21st, 2023? Representative Hollins.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Hollins moves the minutes from February 21st, 2023. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 21st are approved. All right, we have the first bill on the agenda is a Representative Bird bill, and I know she's here because I walked back from the floor with her. Since you're not on the committee, Representative Berg, I will move that House File 406 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry Finance and Policy. I don't see any amendments, and your bill is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This is a very easy bill. I like to say that in my work away from this, I stay in hotels for a living. And having done that for the past 20 years, before I met our testifier who will provide you with a very moving testimony, I never thought about whether or not the room had a carbon monoxide detector. Never thought about whether or not it worked. And so I've learned a lot from our testifier here, and I know that you all will too. And so I'm going to go ahead and yield the rest of my time to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Berg. And your testifier, I believe, is Leslie Lineman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Leslie Lineman, and I am here today to talk about carbon monoxide poisoning, which is a matter of importance to me and my family, but I think should be a matter of importance to everyone in Minnesota. And what I'm asking specifically for you to do is to lead the nation. And I'm doing that because carbon monoxide poisoning in hotels is prevalent throughout the nation, and it is drastically underreported because there is no requirement that leaks, even with injury, are reported. I'm going to jump into the middle of, you know, what I've provided to you. I know I've provided some written testimony as well. But one of the things that shocked me, first of all, was that I sat in a hotel room with my son being poisoned for 3 days and didn't know it. And so when I finally took us to the emergency room because I was afraid that we were going to become unconscious, I didn't have the knowledge to tell the emergency response personnel what was happening, because there was no carbon monoxide detector in the room going off. So it took an hour for them to draw our blood and determine that we had dangerously high levels of carbon monoxide in our blood. And that meant that our treatment was delayed. The only treatment on site is 100% pure oxygen or an oxygen chamber. We were beyond the point where we could be put into an oxygen chamber, and our treatment was delayed because there was no detector in the room. The evacuation of the hotel was delayed by the same amount of time because it took that amount of time for the doctor to understand what was happening and to realize that everyone in the building was in danger. You will see in the materials I provided that that was not a one-time deal from me and my son. When I was in the emergency room and I realized my son had been poisoned and I couldn't see him or hear him, I panicked. But it was absolutely nothing compared to what has happened since. Most people don't realize that the effects of carbon monoxide poisoning can be lifelong, and they have been for me and they will be for my son, who will require medical treatment for the rest of his life because of lack of a carbon monoxide detector that would have cost a hotel $35. And I say that intentionally because in this hotel, there had been prior carbon monoxide incidents. They had still, that had rendered two people unconscious. They still didn't install carbon monoxide detectors. But after we were poisoned, they did, and do you know what it cost? It cost $35. The Minnesota House passed this bill 2 years ago, and we did not get a hearing in the Senate. And since that time, people have said to me that I'm not objective and we can't pass law based on emotion. Well, I do not apologize for the fact that this is emotional to me. I nearly lost my son. But I'm not asking you to make an emotional decision. You were elected by the people of Minnesota to make public policy that protects everyone within the boundaries of this state. I'm asking you to do that job and to do it as though your life depends on it, because let me tell you, it does. I now travel with sometimes one and sometimes two personal carbon monoxide detectors when I have been in hotels. Since nearly losing my life to carbon monoxide poisoning twice in Minnesota hotels, my carbon monoxide detector has detected elevated levels of carbon monoxide when there were either no carbon monoxide detectors in the hotel or they did not detect them. Twice. That's my experience. I've provided to you information documenting at least 15 incidents of carbon monoxide leaks in Minnesota hotels in 2019 and 2020, which is the latest data I have. I can tell you that's underreported, and I know that because there's no reporting requirement. I know that because the carbon monoxide leak that injured me, although it was in Michigan, was never reported to any database anywhere. Only the private foundation, Jenkins Foundation, knows about that because they collect that data on their own. This is not someone else's problem. This is not my problem. But it is a problem that cannot be systemically solved by individual people like me. This is a problem that can only be solved by action of this body, by action of the legislature, to protect the people of Minnesota and the people within the boundaries from carbon monoxide poisoning. And I would like to talk about the business case for carbon monoxide detectors, because that's the other criticism I have received, that I'm not thinking about businesses. Well, I am. My dad managed a grocery store for most of his life. I come from a business background. I am a business owner. I have employees to protect. It doesn't take very long to figure out what it costs a business who has employees who are harmed by carbon monoxide, guests who are harmed by carbon monoxide. The cost to a business of having this go wrong is monumental. There are managers in hotels who have been criminally prosecuted for failure to deal with carbon monoxide leaks. The cost to business of a failure is immense, and it does happen, and it will happen here. And so without spending any more time talking about the information that's in my materials, I would like to end there, but I will ask you again to be a leader in this nation and to do the job of protecting public safety from a deadly gas that you can't see, but a carbon monoxide detector can detect. We can't prevent carbon monoxide leaks, but we can prevent injuries and death from carbon monoxide poisoning, and that's what I'm asking you to do.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Really appreciate you being here today. I think we have someone from the public signed up to testify, Jill Sims. If you want to come up to the testifier table and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jill Sims. I'm Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota. We represent Minnesota's restaurants, hotels, lodging, resort, and campground sectors. Hotel and lodging operators work diligently to ensure the safety of all guests and employees, in particular through adhering to fire code. In March 2020, the Minnesota Fire Code was updated to require carbon monoxide detection in sleeping units where there are fuel-burning appliances or served by a fuel-burning forced air furnace. While well-intentioned, HF 406 does not take into account existing fire code in Minnesota, as well as a few other factors. The bill creates new definitions for hotels and lodging establishments. For continuity purposes, we'd like to see an existing definition like the one found in Minnesota Statute 327.70, which should be used. Also, it should account for vacation rentals, which typically have a significant variety of fuel sources and can also pose risk. The implementation timeline is not considered. The cost, as mentioned, is about $30 to $50 per unit, and there's not clarity at how many units would need to be ordered. We have about 87,000 hotel rooms in Minnesota, but like I mentioned, existing statute does already require many of these rooms to have that. And so with some supply chain issues in place and hotel budgets are done significantly in advance, we just need more time in terms of implementation. And even if a hotel were to be able to secure the units, there are some labor shortages that pose challenges for installation. And again, the hotel inspections are done on a 3-year annual basis by the fire marshal. Last, we would ensure that violations are accordance with existing violation process for state fire code. So we'd like more time to work with the author and to work with the hotel industry as well as the state fire marshal so we can better understand the existing rules and regulations and then collaboratively identify opportunities to work together, likely through rulemaking and as well as finding other education opportunities. Thank you.
Thanks for testimony. Any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. I've always been honored to be on this same bill with you, and this is important. There's two aspects of this, and thank you to the hotel and restaurant people for coming forward today. Those are really good, important points, but the scene I was on and participated in was about 30 patients that had to be transferred. They all had electric heaters. It was like your normal hotel where it's not a fuel burning source. What it was three cars in the parking lot that were left running that came in through the regular means. And then just to also take into one of the treatments that we use for CO poisoning is the hyperbaric chamber. And there's only one in the state that can be used here. It's in Hennepin County. We had to transfer 30 patients from outstate into this facility. It was a while ago. But it's very, very costly. That's supported by the state that chamber is. And so I think this is a great bill. It could save money. And I really think we do need to work with hotel and restaurant. But I think that there's things that they can't control that we need to do for a $30 bill here. So thank you, Representative Berg.
Representative Hollins.
Sorry, I didn't realize I'd be next. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, for bringing this bill. So I just want to point out to everybody here that this is what public safety is, right? This is the Public Safety Committee, and we talk a lot about law enforcement and crime, but this is public safety too. And I didn't know that this was an issue until this bill came before us 2 years ago, right, back in 2021. And it was horrifying. And so ever since then, when I've gone to hotels or stayed at Airbnbs, I'm like looking and to see, is there some sort of mitigations process here? Is there like an alarm that's gonna tell me if my babies are being poisoned? And I think this is just common sense, public safety provision. And I am sympathetic to the hotel and restaurant industry, but what I will say is that this is the third year that we've heard this bill, and there's been a lot of time for us to discuss like what sort of mitigating circumstances we can put into here or how we might be able to work together. And you know, the cost of a carbon monoxide detector is, even the cost of 87,000 of them, is worth the life of a child that could be lost or even an adult that could be lost. So I am definitely in support of this bill, and I want to thank you for bringing it. And Leslie, thank you for always coming here and sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Berg. I didn't see a fiscal note, so I don't know if this is a reporting or an enforcement, and who would do the enforcement of it.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. That's a great point. A lot of this has to do with reporting and therefore changes in the code that we would need to make. There wouldn't be a fiscal note because the responsibility would be on each establishment to adhere to this law. And I will say somebody mentioned Airbnb, which is also relevant because this is actually the fifth year this bill has come forward. In the meantime, since we've been working on this, Airbnb has required their properties to have carbon monoxide detectors in each room that is designated for sleeping. And if the Airbnb host cannot afford it, they will provide it for them. That's how seriously Airbnbs are taking this. So I'm hoping our hotels will do the same. I'm happy to work with them. But as I told them, I am going to unapologetically stand firm that we do this. How we do it, I'm happy to keep having conversations about. That was a little long, but.
Thank you. And I do agree with Representative Hollins and Representative Hewitt on I've been at the scenes of hotels that aren't regulated or it's after the fact. And so that's why I was wondering how are we going to protect them if we don't have an enforcement part of it? And the only way you'll know is after the fact where there's an incident. So that's why I was looking at the enforcement piece. That's the only reason I was looking at it.
Representative Burke. Madam Chair and Representative, it's my understanding that once this is in statute, sort of the fire marshal and that entity would be the enforcement agency. I'm not sure if my testifier has different information. No.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Burke, thank you for bringing this forward. I think it is an important issue, but I have a question. You make several references in the bill to it being an alarm as opposed to a detector. And I think if we're using a true carbon monoxide alarm, something that's wired in or monitored or will be reporting something, that's more than the $35 things. Do you feel that would adversely affect the cost of the hotels?
President Park.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Novotny. That's a great question. In our bill, we do not designate specifically whether you need a carbon monoxide detector that is battery operated or if you need the more expensive one that is wired into the hotel wiring system. We don't require that this bill makes that choice for the hotels. So you're correct. The battery operated are going to be significantly less cost than the ones that are wired in. That determination in the way this is written now can be made by each establishment.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Representative Berg, my question is the difference between the carbon monoxide detector that will read it in the room as opposed to an alarm, something that's connected to something else. So something that will send out a notification is what my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, is what a true alarm is. Are we talking about detectors or are we talking about alarms?
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Novotny. Great. So I'm understanding your question a little bit better. We can work on the language. We are talking about something that detects the levels of carbon monoxide in the room and therefore alarms to notify you that there are unsafe levels in the room. So if we need to do some changing of language, happy to do that.
Just note in my own home, I just have the battery, operated ones, and they certainly do. If they detect anything, the alarm is loud and clear, and usually it's at 3 a.m, right? Representative Novotny.
Well, thank you, Chair Moeller. And as you know, I have severe tinnitus, so the alarms go off in my house, and unless the dog starts barking, I'm not going to know it. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And I just wanted to say, I just Googled it while we were sitting here, and it's 1997 at Target to buy an alarm. And I think to the enforcement piece, if we're to make this law, I would guess all of us and other people, as we learn that this becomes law, the same way you would report any other thing that you notice in a hotel that isn't safe, you could report that and then folks could look into it. So the same way lots of other rules that we have about lodging and other businesses where if you're relying on both the regular inspections and the public reporting things as they notice things. And I know too from being friends with a lot of firefighters that they notice things just when they're out living their lives the same way that we probably notice things as legislators. So I think there would be the public is also another mechanism that we can help hold folks accountable if it's when this becomes law.
Any closing comments, Representative Burke?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the lawyers in the room that Googled that and got us on track. Yes, I would like to make closing remarks, which I was not going to cry through. These are dear friends of mine. Leslie forced me by believing in me to run, which is why I'm sitting in front of you today. I have known her family, her son, for years. And I'm sorry if this is a little personal. I have known them before this, and I now know them after this, and there is a significant difference. This is something that could affect any one of us at any time, unexpectedly, but with long-term and immense consequences. I ask that you support this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I renew my motion that House File 406 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you so much, Representative Hurd. All right, our next bill is House File 1406, Representative Frazier. And I believe, Representative Frazier, your motion is that House File 1406 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. I don't see that you have an amendment. So I think there's – are you perhaps doing a PowerPoint with yours, or do you want to make some opening comments?
I'm making opening comments.
All right. Go right ahead, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, committee members. I am here today with House File 1406, which seeks to reform our felony murder aiding and abetting law. Currently in Minnesota, a person can be charged with and convicted of murder even though they did not kill anyone or intend for anyone to die or anticipate that death would occur. This is because of our aiding and abetting homicide laws. I'd like to thank Chair Moeller and Chair Pinto for all the work they have done on this legislation over the last few years, as well as the many advocates and law enforcement that have been a part of this conversation to get us to this point. You know, the impacts of the current law has been uneven, to say the least. 56% of those charged are under the age of 25, 48% charged are black, and 80% of those convicted are people of color. And the majority have little or no criminal history prior to that. In short, this law has a significant and disproportional life-changing impact on certain populations of our state, but we have a chance to fix that. In 2021, a bipartisan legislative task force, including county attorneys, police chiefs, victim advocates, impacted people, public defenders, and other experts, examined Minnesota's aiding and abetting felony murder doctrine, compared it to other states, and looked at patterns and who is charged and punished under the doctrine. Shortly, you will hear from members of that task force, and they will lay out how we got to the current legislative proposal to modernize our laws and provide relief for those that have been impacted by the current law. This has been a bipartisan effort in the past, and I expect it to remain as such. The current Senate bill has bipartisan support, and we'll have a hearing soon in the Senate. With that, Madam Chair, I will yield to our testifiers.
Thank you so much. It looks like we have Perry Moriarty up at the testifier table. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Perry Moriarty. I'm a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Over the last decade, I have researched and written about some of the laws that we're going to be discussing today. And my students and I have also represented a few people that have been impacted by these laws. I, along with Claire Deagle of the Minnesota ACLU, am here to discuss the genesis and the components of HF 1406. I'll start with the legislature's creation of the bipartisan task force that Representative Frazier just mentioned, and then talk about some of the work we did and why we did it. So, can I advance the slides?
She have the ability to advance the slides, or does someone else have to?
Let's see.
Maybe I can.
And then Ms. Deagle will jump in and talk about the task force's recommendations and the specific components of the bill. So first, to the establishment of the task force. The task force was created in June 2021 and was truly bipartisan. As you can see, the members represented a wide range of offices and perspectives, and the mandate was clear. Collect data on Minnesota's aiding and abetting felony murder laws, obtain relevant information on the laws of other states, analyze the efficacy and equity of our current laws, and make recommendations to the legislature. Both Ms. Deagle and I were members of the task force. There were several things that drove the creation of the task force. One of them was fundamental concerns about both the efficacy and equity of Minnesota's current laws. The data we collected reinforced those concerns. Here is what we found out. First, people charged with and convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder in Minnesota are disproportionately black and brown. Of the people charged with aiding and abetting felony murder between 2010 and 2019, 80% were people of color. Nearly half were black in a state with a population that averaged 6% black at the time. People charged with and convicted of felony murder in Minnesota are also disproportionately young. 63% of those convicted over this 10-year period were under 25, at an age when we now know their brains were continuing to develop. 42% of those convicted were in just one county, Hennepin County, which suggests that geography may play a disproportionate role in the application of Minnesota's laws. And finally, the imposition of the punishments themselves were disparate. And I'll turn, if we could turn to the next slide, I'll say a bit more about this. Both the aiding and abetting and felony murder doctrines have long been controversial in both this country and internationally for one basic reason. Their convergence allows a person to be charged with and punished for murder without ever intending to kill or in some cases even harm anyone. This violates one of the criminal law's core axioms, that a person should be held accountable for the harm they intended, and they should be punished in accordance with their culpability. To do otherwise is fundamentally unfair and unjust. It is this inherent unfairness that has led every common law country but the U.S., England, Ireland, Canada, India, and Australia to abolish felony murder as a doctrine. It has also prompted four U.S. states to abolish felony murder and many others to do what we are now proposing, limit homicide liability to those who intended or were major participants in a homicide. And finally, the last slide. Limiting Minnesota law in this way is especially important because in its current form, our aiding and abetting statute and its interpretive case law allows for especially expansive liability. Though the statute refers to intentional aid, courts have interpreted it to say that knowledge is enough and that active participation in the overt acts of a homicide is not required to be held liable. When this law is combined with Minnesota's felony murder laws, it means that someone like Jamecia Donerson, who you will hear from in just a bit, can be charged with first-degree murder at the age of 16, even though she was sitting outside the place where the homicide occurred in a car when two 23-year-old men killed another man. That is something that should not happen in this state, and what we are proposing today will change it. I'll now yield to Ms. Deagle.
Thank you. Claire Deagle, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Claire Deagle, C-L-A-R-E-D-I-E-G-E-L. I'm a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, and in that capacity, I served as a member of the Task Force on Aiding and Abetting Felony Murder, and I'm testifying today in my capacity as a member of that task force. I'm going to be talking about the task force's three key recommendations and then getting in a little bit into the bill that is being presented here today. The task force members unanimously recommended, first, revising relevant statutes to limit aiding and abetting felony murder so that liability would attach when someone actually caused the death, had an intent to cause the death, or acted as a major participant in the underlying felony and acted with reckless disregard for human life. This recommendation ensures that convictions are commensurate with someone's individual culpability. And this recommendation resolves the wide-ranging disparities that Professor Moriarty spoke about. This recommendation was advanced by victims groups, such as the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, which is a statewide victims' rights and advocacy membership coalition, and it was also supported by Violence Free Minnesota, a statewide coalition working to end relationship abuse with 80 member programs providing services to victims and survivors in 87 counties. This recommendation was also in line with how other states are seeking to limit liability for aiding and abetting felony murder, as Professor Moriarty spoke about. The task force members also unanimously recommended that we revise relevant statutes such that those previously convicted may petition for limited relief. Allowing for retroactive relief is the only way to ensure that an individual receives a conviction and a sentence that is commensurate with their culpability. And it is the only way to resolve the enormous and problematic disparities that are resulting from the current state of the law. The task force members also unanimously recommended to implement reforms beyond the mere adoption of an affirmative defense for aiding and abetting felony murder. Our task force conducted a 50-state survey where we looked at the different laws affecting aiding and abetting felony murder in the United States. Some of those states allowed someone charged with aiding and abetting felony murder to assert affirmative defenses. But our bipartisan task force was unanimous that Minnesota not go this route. The reasons were multiple. I'll just quickly highlight two. The first was just based on principle. An affirmative defense shifts the burden on the defendant to prove their innocence in opposition to the majority of criminal law. The second consideration was practical. The bipartisan task force feared that affirmative defenses would be so burdensome on a petitioner who likely would not be represented by counsel that the impact would actually be negligible, that someone would not actually be able to seek retroactive relief if we are putting the burden on them to prove an affirmative defense. HF 1406 addresses and implements those three key recommendations. And I'm just going to highlight three core provisions. First, it would limit liability for first-degree felony murder to those who caused the death or aided and abetted with the intent to cause the death of a human being. So no one charged or convicted of first-degree murder would be, for example, the getaway driver for a robbery. Second, the bill as written limits liability for second-degree murder to those who caused death or were a major participant in the underlying felony and acted with extreme indifference to human life. I'm going to briefly discuss the term major participant that's in the bill. This term has origins in U.S. Supreme Court cases from 1982 and 1983. In those cases, the court was discussing a spectrum of culpability for felony murder and ultimately decided that someone who's, quote, a major participant and acted with reckless indifference to human life, while not on equal footing to someone who actually caused the death, was still culpable. California recently adopted the term major participant in its reform law on aiding and abetting felony murder. The third provision I will touch on in the bill is the provision for retroactive relief. This provision allows those currently incarcerated or in supervised relief for convictions of aiding and abetting first-degree felony murder and aiding and abetting second-degree intentional felony murder to seek retroactive relief. And there are three primary components. First, there would be notification by the Department of Corrections of those who are eligible to seek retroactive relief. Those individuals would then file a preliminary application, and if that application was approved, they would be permitted to file a petition for retroactive relief. If a judge reviewing the petition granted it, that individual would be allowed to be resentenced. And given the resentencing provision and the current lack of case law in Minnesota on the definition of major participant, it became important for some of us to decide how major participant may be defined. And so the definition of major participant was something that many stakeholders last year expressed concerns about, or they expressed concerns that there was a lack of definition in the previous bill. So because of that, some of the task force members came together and tried to draft a proposed definition of major participant, and that's what you can see on the screen here. The definition of major participant that we have proposed holds accountable those who played a substantial role and acted with extreme indifference to human life. And in creating this definition, we were informed by all of the research the task force had done on aiding and abetting felony murder in Minnesota, as well as the stories we had heard from prosecutors, defense attorneys, and impacted people, including victims groups. This definition was also informed by the now substantial California case law on the definition of major participant, which goes back to 2015, as well as the jury instructions on major participant in California that codified that case law. And with that, Madam Chair, I yield my time to.
And before you do, just a quick question on the major participant. So is it your intent to amend this, what you just talked about, into future versions of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. That is likely the intent. There has been discussion with the different stakeholders and members of the task force around if it would be put directly into the statute, or if it would be another way would be through jury instructions. But we're having a conversation, and we'll have a decision by the time we get to judiciary.
Great, thanks. I figured if I was wondering that, other people might have been wondering the same thing. So just get that clarity right now. Okay, we have another testifier. It's Jamicia Donerson. Welcome to the committee. It's great to see you. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jamicia Donerson. Thanks for letting me testify to this bill. Give me 1 second and I'm pulling.
If you could pull the mic just a little bit closer too, that would be great.
Okay. 1 second. All right. So my name is Jamicia Donerson. At the age of 16, a situation occurred at home where I felt it was unsafe for me to live there. I then turned to the streets for comfort. During that time, I started dating an adult male. This adult male murdered someone while I was in the car. I did not know my victim, nor did I see my victim's face. From that point on, my 16-year-old life has changed. I was charged and convicted of murder when I never murdered anyone. I was sentenced as an adult, but I could not be around adults at the time per the jailhouse rules or whatever. But I couldn't be around adults because of my age. Therefore, I was placed on 23 hours lockdown in an adult facility, which took a toll on my mental. I never understood how I was charged and convicted as an adult, but I was kept away from adults. I was sentenced to 12 years. During my incarceration, I had to figure out how to become an adult. I got my GED. I took college courses and got certified as a paralegal, only to discover once I was released, my paralegal certificate wasn't any use due to the school not being accredited. I also faced challenges of getting an apartment, getting a job, and being labeled as a murderer. No matter how much you try to explain to a employer or a landlord that it says murder on my background. It says murder on my background. It says murder on my background check, but I never murdered anyone. They don't believe you. You are what they say you are on your background check. After serving time in prison, I thought for sure I would live a normal life. To this day, 15 years later, I'm still punished for a murder I did not commit. I'm now starting my family. I have a little one on the way. And recently tried to get life insurance and found out a company would not accept me due to being convicted as a murderer. 15 years later, I'm what you call a productive adult. I have a job that I love, a place called home. I pay my taxes, but somehow I get punished for a bad choice someone made 15 years ago. When would the punishment ever stop? Please change this law. Every day I have to prepare myself for a fight and ready to explain to the world how I'm not what they are, what they say I'm on my background check. I'm Jamecia Donison, a human trying to live a productive life. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sorry. Thank you so much. You're the reason why retroactivity is so important, you and so many like you. So thanks for sharing your story with us. Do we have other members of the public who wish to testify? All right, we will open it up for member questions. We do have an amendment first, so let's take care of that. The A1 amendment, is that yours, Representative Novotny, or somebody else?
It is Chair Mueller.
All right, please explain your A1 amendment.
The bill as it's formatted has all of the applications going through the Ramsey County District Court. My amendment changes that the petition would be filed where the person was convicted. And it would change on line 3, or page 3, line 16, it would delete a judge in said court and insert a judge who sentenced the applicant or that judge's replacement. Feel that there's a real value in having the judges and the courts that were involved in the case and have knowledge of the background of the case involved in the review of the case and any modifications to this case going forward. I don't know why all the cases in the other 86 counties would come to Ramsey County and the Ramsey County attorney. That's my amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Novotny, and I can't argue with you in terms of the reason behind the reason you brought this amendment. And that is another piece. We're working on a technical amendment that will be coming for judiciary. And I'm going to ask members not to accept this language because we would just change it. We are communicating with prosecutors and other folks in the system to have language that will specifically do exactly what you are referring to. This particular language is in here now. The intent was for it to go back after going through this clearinghouse in Ramsey County. And the reason we put it there was many of these cases are in Ramsey and in Hennepin. The idea was to have a clearinghouse where there would be more of an expert to review these cases and then send them back to the original jurisdiction where they would be then addressed in that original jurisdiction. We want to make that language clear because I agree with you wholeheartedly that it should go back and it will go back to the original jurisdiction so they can cover that. So I'll ask for a no vote, but I want you to know, I want you to know I will share the language with you to our review as we move it forward to judiciary. So thank you for bringing that.
And I'll just add, too, I was involved when the retroactivity piece was being reworked and got some great assistance from nonpartisan staff on that. And the intent to create this special master was really also to help get rid of some of those, like, frivolous claims so they're not all going to the all around the state, all over the state, to kind of do sort of a weeding out of the ones that have validity. And then when that decision is made, then they would get sent to the district court in the jurisdiction where the conviction occurred. So was really to kind of streamline the process as well, because we anticipate that a lot of folks will apply for this right away.
Yeah.
Also, let's see, member discussion. Representative Pinto.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. And I was just going to build on that point just to note that, as written, the bill does require the county attorney's office in the original county to participate. So I think that's a little bit of a contrast to Representative Novotny described. And I would think that, and I guess I'll see if the bill's author, what he thinks of this, but I would think you certainly want to have the final, if it turns out that there seems to be a meritorious claim, to have the final decision made and the final arguments in that district court. But it seems like there's still an advantage to having a single statewide screening just to avoid burdening counties with maybe a number of frivolous claims possibly. So I guess to my mind, it seems like this is actually pretty close to what we would end up wanting, except that in the end, you'd want to make sure that a meritorious claim would go back to that county. Thanks.
Representative Frazier.
Yes, thank you, Representative Pinto, and to what I was referring to, Representative Novotny. The intent is to make sure it gets back to that original county so that decisions are made in that original county. Thank you.
All right, any further discussion on the A1 amendment?
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
The A1 amendment is not adopted. All right, now we can move on to a discussion of the bill. Member discussion. Representative Beckerman.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And we didn't explicitly discuss this, but for me, any discussion of this issue and this bill needs to include a discussion around domestic violence and domestic abuse and those relationships of power and control that the folks who are currently most impacted by this bill. I know as a prosecutor and the cases that I worked on and what I've learned about around this bill as we've discussed it in the time I've been in office, that often is the case. And so I think it's just really important that we remember that you know, we may think that a person who it's not a clear, like, you're asked to ride in a car or you're asked to drive a car, and it's not necessarily like you have the full ability to say yes or no one way or another if you're in an abusive relationship. And so I think it's really important that we recognize that a lot of the folks who may currently be incarcerated or as our testifier and others, it's not a fully free relationship that they're in when they're agreeing to participate, or, you know, whether it's driving a car or making a phone call or things like that. So I wanted to lift that up because I think it's really important, and I think that's why you kind of disproportionately see younger folks, a lot of times women, folks who are in those relationships, if that's actually what's going on. And so the idea that then some of those folks who would do more time than the person who actually pulled the trigger or did the action is, you know, out of basic sense of fairness and what we should want to see in a justice system that just isn't just. And so I'm very supportive of these efforts. I'm hoping this is finally the year that we can do more than a task force. I think the task force was important, but it's time that we actually take action so the people most impacted can see the results of the work we've been doing. So thank you, Representative Frazier, and look forward to making the bill even better in Judiciary Committee.
Representative Hollins.
Sorry, my microphone fell. Thank you, Chair Moeller, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I guess, so first of all, I'm totally in support of this bill, I think, as you know. You know, when your testifier was up speaking, I was thinking, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, because I've had enough experiences. I had some friends in high school that got into trouble, and I could absolutely see myself in this exact same situation. And I guess one of my questions, I'm just thinking about this from a legal perspective, like, what was the intent when this was originally put into law? Like, what was it, deterrence? What was the original intent of this, you know, felony murder situation? I mean, I don't really understand, because why does it exist?
Ms. Moriarty.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and thank you very much, Representative. I won't go too deep into it except to say that the law originates in Old English doctrine, and the original intent was to be able to hold someone liable who was sort of the mastermind of a criminal enterprise but was not necessarily present at the time. And so the bootstrapping mechanism was to penalize the underlying felony and impute intent otherwise. Unfortunately, when the doctrine was adopted in the U.S., it expanded pretty dramatically, and every state ultimately developed its own felony murder rule, I think probably without a lot of thought about the aiding and abetting doctrine's interaction with the felony murder rule, is my guess. And what we found is that we are one of the only countries in the world that continues to utilize this doctrine in ways that feel so fundamentally unfair when it comes to underlying culpability. I wish I could say I think the rationale originally was deterrence. You want to deter people from committing felonies because there's this specter of punishment. But all the studies that have been done suggest that it doesn't work.
you can't deter someone from doing something they didn't intend. And I think that's really what we're coming to find and why so many states are taking action. Thank you.
Thanks for that clarity. That was spoken like a true law professor. I felt like I was back in law school for a minute there, but it was really clear.
Not the coolest thing, but.
Any follow-up from Sam Hollins?
Just short, yeah. Thank you. That is really helpful when we're thinking about this law, because I think, you know, in law school, we spend a lot of time thinking about how our criminal statutes interact with, like, the people's minds. And the reality is people don't think about, like, oh, well, if I commit this and somebody happens to die in it, I didn't know that this is going to be a heightened punishment that I'm going to have to, you know, be responsible for. And that's not something that anybody processes when they are committing a crime, right? We know that. People aren't sophisticated enough, nor do they have, like, that capacity a lot of the time. And then aiding and abetting, it's, like, even further removed from that idea where you would have no expectation that you would be punished for sitting in a car waiting for somebody to come out of a building. And so I think this is absolutely necessary. It just doesn't make logical sense, and it's not helping anybody. It's just further penalizing people and having impacts into their lives for years and years and years down the road. So, I mean, I can't say any better than you did. You know, when is my punishment going to stop? When have I paid my price? So thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for being here and bringing this bill.
Representative Mueller.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you, Representative Frazier. I was listening to your testifiers, and one of them said that, let me go back to my notes, that, for example, someone who was actually involved in what is happening intentionally in causing death, intended to cause death, had a major contribution to cause death, and then said this. So this means that the person who was in the getaway car or was driving the getaway car would not be charged. That's what was said. So I was reading the definition of major participant, and I just want to know how someone who, assuming they knew what that was going on, I understand, but how does that not follow under major participant? Like, I'm reading through what it is here. Who used a deadly weapon, okay. Who played a principal role, that seems principal role being the getaway car, was not present at the time, doesn't matter. But number four, who impeded another person from preventing the death, either by physical action or by threat. So I just don't know how a getaway car driver person, now, I get that you were just throwing out an example. I just wanted to know, because I think it's really important that we have this definition in the bill, because it gives a lot of clarity. And I think that that's really important. And so I just felt like your example didn't match what your definition had here. So if I could just get some clarity, that'd be great.
Ms. Deagle, Chair. Yep, Ms. Deagle, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Representative. I will say that one thing that makes these cases kind of complicated to talk about generally is the totality of the circumstances and how everything really, how every little fact really matters. I use the example of the getaway driver, excuse me, because in those Supreme Court cases from 1982 to 1983, the court used a getaway driver who would be in the car taking someone away from a robbery as one end of the spectrum of culpability, and the person who actually caused the death as another. So that was the reason that I used that language. But to your question, so the major participant definition that is proposed here on this slide, the second subsection there, it's meant to apply to a person who played a principal role in the act that proximately caused the death. So that is one distinction. Also, major participant is just one part of, is just one of the elements for this section. So it's, if you look at the, for second degree murder, it's someone who was a major participant and acted with extreme indifference to human life. So arguably, an individual who is just driving someone to a robbery, you know, then we get into the, did they know there was robbery? Did they know there was a gun in the car? Did they know that the person they were with had a criminal history, you know, of violence. Like, there are all these different factors, which is why we think it's important to try to come up with an expansive definition that also, this is going to sound like I just contradicted myself, but a definition that limits who is going to be found to be a major participant, but also that we have thought through the different scenarios such that the people who are culpable are held accountable under this definition. So that is why we decided not to just use like a list of factors to consider. You know, we didn't think that was going to accurately capture who would be a major participant. So I appreciate the question and the chance to clarify, and I hope I addressed your concern.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, in a room full of lawyers, which I am not one, I was a teacher for almost 20 years, and, you know, sometimes what gets people frustrated with lawyerese, can I use that new word?
Yeah.
That's the word I'm using. That, you know, people just look at it and be like, well, of course, you know, this person put themselves in a situation that is, whether they knew it or not, that it was suspicious or sus, as the kids say, right? That's right. I was a high school teacher. Bring it. And so it's one of those things where I don't want anyone going to jail or serving for a crime that they didn't commit. There was a reason why we had these laws, and if we need to modernize them, I think that's incredibly important that we look at them, and I appreciate what the task force brings. I just want to make sure that when we are looking at major participant, that definition is clear, that definition is going to, you know, make sure that we are putting the people who should be behind bars, but not, it's such a horrible case that what we heard today, you know, that's a heart-wrenching thing. I've also listened to several people in my community as well. So, you know, sometimes the lawyer language gets in the way of just what normal people understand and look at. And so just a concern. That's why I really, really encourage Representative Frazier that we amend this so that we can have a really good, clear definition of major participant there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in follow-up to Representative Mueller's comments, I just wanted to clarify that if somebody is driving the getaway car, they are still guilty of something. We just don't think they should be guilty of aiding and abetting felony murder. I just wanted to make that clarification. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So first, just building on Representative Hollins' point, I guess I view this as being, I mean, felony murder is itself a kind of a doctrine that's pretty out far on a limb, as the professor was saying. When you combine that with aiding and abetting, the two in combination kind of send us geometrically. It's a real problem at that point, and that's really what this is addressing. And then I also just wanted to acknowledge, I mean, this is clearly the result of thoughtful policy. We can see the PowerPoint and really hard work. I want to acknowledge the chair's efforts in particular, that a lot of the language in 1406, I hope you don't mind, Chair Mullen, my pointing out, was basically drafted by the chair herself. trying to work through and drawing her expertise as an appellate lawyer. But this has also been a labor of love. The families who have experienced this in their families are making sure that other people don't have to experience it as well. And when they came to Chair Mueller and me a couple years ago and said, we really want to get this addressed, we said, you know, it really has to be studied. There has to be a task force. So they put together a task force. The task force came together and came back, guess what, with unanimous recommendations. Unanimous. And they have had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And if we can get some justice for them and then on behalf of other families as well, we'll be doing terrific work. So thank you, Representative Frazier, for taking up the mantle and driving at this session. Thanks, Chair Mueller.
Thanks. Representative Devani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Mueller summarized it pretty well. Not fluent in lawyerese, but I just want to make sure and thank you for all the clarifications. First of all, I just want to say, let's just agree to disagree that if you're driving a getaway car on a drug rip or an armed robbery. Yeah, that's part of the, that's what, you know, you're doing a robbery. That's, you know, you're not doing, if it was shoplifting, I absolutely agree with you. But I know where this is going to go, and I, you know, we'll just have to agree to disagree. One of the things I'd like to point out, and going forward, the Uniform Crime Report was just released, and I pulled up the numbers for homicides, and it's kind of reflective from what I heard about. We talk about the disparities. We have to fix it because of disparities. In 2021, there were 201 statewide homicides. 170 of those were in the 7-county metro area, which is a which leaves 31 for the rest of the other 80 counties. And for the other 87 counties, that was a 13%, almost a 14% decrease over the year before. If I look at the Uniform Crime Report and pull up the numbers and I look at the race of the victims, it almost matches the race of the suspects. If we look at the suspects that are known and their sex, that almost matches the race of the suspects and the victims. And I know it's been a recurring theme that I plan to bring up in the future, but we have not one consideration here of the victims. And I, like I said, it's another thing that we're just going to have to agree to disagree on, but I think if we spent more time worrying about the victims and preventing more victims, I think that'd be a better place to focus our attention. But with that, Madam Chair, I'll give it back to you.
Thank you. And before I turn it to closing comments, I'm just going to make a few comments about this because this is something that I've worked on for a couple of years. You do have in your packets letters from two of the victim advocacy organizations, including Violence Free Minnesota, Minnesota Alliance on Crime, which was mentioned in the testimony as the General Crime Victim Coalition. I used to be the executive director of that. And I think one of the things that's really compelling is the second to the last paragraph in that one, talking about a family member of a homicide victim who felt like this felony murder aiding and abetting law was not appropriate to apply in that in their loved one's case because that person didn't have the intent or the knowledge that's required for murder. So we are talking about victims in this bill. We're also talking about victims in many other arenas, as we've heard in committee and in any number of bills that we've heard. And the years that go by that we don't do this, people that are here have loved ones who are currently incarcerated waiting for action from us. And people like Jamesia, who testified, whose life is forever impacted by how the aiding and abetting and felony murder rule unfairly combine for people. So. I feel very passionately about this, and I'm looking forward to voting and moving this forward. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank everybody for the conversation. I just would like to quickly just say a little bit about Representative Botany's closing comments. There is a section in the bill starting at line 5.27 that requires communication with the victim if in this process, if someone is appealing to have their sentence changed once this law goes into effect. So they're thinking about the victims. And Chair Mola just mentioned the letters of support that are provided from victim advocacy groups. I also want to say, Representative Vodney, I appreciate the lens that you bring to this discussion coming from the law enforcement background. And I do want to point out the facts that crime is going down. And we know there are multiple factors that play into that. And I also appreciate the fact that you pointed out the nuance that when crime happens, oftentimes in the community, it is someone from that community. And that means that oftentimes they are of the same race. So in the metro, because of the higher population, we have higher crimes, as you mentioned. And then also in greater Minnesota, most of those crimes are committed by folks that look like them from their community. So I think it's important that you pointed that out. So I'm glad that you did. Just to close out, I'd like to say, we heard Jamisha's story here, and she is representative of folks throughout this state and folks that are still currently incarcerated that are waiting for us to do something to modernize a law that is causing great harm and impact. I can't say more than what she shared in her lived experience, and I am hopeful that we'll get this done this year and we will start making change for the better and have a positive and create a positive impact for those individuals that have been impacted by this arcane law. Members vote yes.
And with that, Representative Frazier renews the motion that House File 1406 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right, thanks again to all our testifiers. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 1607. That is Majority Leader Long bill. And since you're no longer on the committee, Majority Leader Long, I will move to lay over House File 1607. And I do see that we have an A2 author's amendment, so I will also move the amendment. And Representative Long, can you please explain the amendment to us?
Happy to, Chair Mueller. So the amendment will do three things. It fixes an inconsistency with regard to the length of sentence for gross misdemeanor DWIs. It clarifies that if a court ordered consecutive periods of probation for different crimes, this would still apply. And it requires the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to modify their policies consistent with the statute.
All right, any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Right, Representative Long, please explain your bill to us as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair Mueller. Colleagues, the length of our probation terms in Minnesota are failing the basic tests of fairness, wasting resources, and not achieving our goals of reducing recidivism or increasing public safety. Minnesota rightly prides itself on being on the low end nationally for time spent in prison, but we have been an outlier when it comes to probation. While Minnesota has the sixth lowest incarceration rate, Minnesota has the sixth highest rate of people on community supervision. And when you combine these, we are not at all a low punishment state. It is largely a good thing that Minnesota focuses on probation over incarceration. Community supervision has many benefits, and if done well, can be much more tailored to help individuals succeed and reintegrate. But probation is still punishment, and the balance has tilted so far towards probation that the average probation term in Minnesota is longer than the average prison term. In part, that's because Minnesota's probation limit was the statutory maximum penalty for the offense, which can be as high as 40 years. Thankfully, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission took action in 2020 to limit probation to 5 years, except for homicides and criminal sexual conduct. This bill would codify the actions of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and would take a step that they were unable to by righting past wrongs and making this retroactive. Probation in Minnesota is not a light touch, and it has real impacts on people's lives. Probation can make it harder to keep a job. Routine check-in requirements can impact employment. Treatment conditions can require transportation and scheduling flexibility. Courts can often require probation terms that are not tailored to the individual offender as well. One example is alcohol restrictions, which are often put on even if unrelated to the offense. And as we've talked about on the floor and in committee, probation also restricts civil rights like voting, but hopefully not for much longer. Another concern with our probation system is that it is applied unequally. Before the Sentencing Guidelines Commission acted, in some parts of Minnesota, the average probation length was 3 years, while in others, it was 7 years. Even since the Guidelines Commission's action for judicial departures from the five-year cap in 2021, there were 52 judicial departures in the 7th Judicial District, while there was one judicial departure in the 4th Judicial District and zero in the 6th Judicial District. This fails the basic test that justice should be applied fairly across geography. Five-year probation caps are common in other states. This includes peer states like Missouri and Iowa. It also includes states that aren't typically viewed as soft on crime, like Alabama and Mississippi. Prior to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission action, 87% of felony probation sentences statewide were already under 5 years. Research also shows that probation revocations are far more likely to happen in the first 3 years. From 2002 to 2012, 1% or less of offenders had their sentences revoked after 5 years. Long probation is not rehabilitative. Research shows it is no more likely for a person with a long probation term to commit a crime than one with a five-year probation term. Probation officers have all the information they need to determine whether an individual is fit to remain in society after 5 years. So what's happening in year 15 or 20 or 40 of a probation term? Well, not much, except taking up space in a probation officer caseload, that could better be targeted towards those who are greater at risk. And waiting to see if they made a mistake that could send them back to prison, even if they met all their probation terms for years or even decades. Between 2001 and 2021, over 36,000 people in Minnesota were sentenced to probation terms longer than 5 years. I don't know exactly how many of these individuals are still on probation, but I know that it's too many. Efforts to cap probation lengths at 5 years have long had the support of a broad group of stakeholders. Correction Commissioner Schnell wanted me to mention that he is in full support of this bill today, and I know that we also have some testifiers here to speak to the bill, if that time is now, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Looks like we've got Jennifer Schroeder here, so welcome back to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Mueller, Vice Chair, I'm Jennifer Schroeder, and I believe I've testified in front of some of you before, so just because we're running a little low on time, I'm going to spare some of my backstory.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. Sorry, I forgot to announce that we do have until 12:30 because hearings were canceled last week because of the snow. We had permission today to go until 12:30. So if your stomach is grumbling and you're ready for lunch, we've got you until 12:30. So okay. Go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, then I will just go with what I was originally going to. My story starts out like so many former addicts. I come from a broken home full of broken people. My addiction slowly consumed me until it was the only thing I knew, and looking back, it's unbelievable that I wasted 25 years of my life in addiction. What changed everything was the day that my newborn daughter was taken from the hospital. She was tested positive for drugs, and I got pulled over 3 weeks later. I had got sober, but I was still selling drugs because that's the only thing I knew how to do. I used with my parents since I was a kid. I grew up in a home that addiction was normal. I was bounced around from foster homes, group homes, you know. I was so relieved when I got pulled over because I was exhausted. I was so exhausted from living that life. So I just hit the ground running, and I was sentenced to a year in jail. I got pulled over, and so I got a possession charge. Just a possession charge, that's all I got. I was sentenced to 40 years of probation. I served 1 year in jail, and my rights were terminated to my daughter. She was adopted out for a possession charge. And this lit a fire inside of me, and I hit the ground running. I went to college. I was busing 2 hours to go to school one way because I had nothing when I got out of jail, nothing. I had no credit. I had no license. I had no family support. I had nothing. I had to rebuild my life from the ground. And then on probation, so I was busing all the way back to Wright County to go to probation meetings every 3 months. It was a lot of work that I put in, and I did this all under 5 years. So if somebody doesn't want to change their life in 5 years, they're not going to. The resources that we pour into probation and long terms, and not only that, I see, because I have got my degree in addiction counseling, so now I'm working in the field. The people that are violating on minor infractions and getting sent back to prison is astounding. And the fear that you live with if you're on probation and you're doing the right thing is still something that resonates with me every day. I could be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I have a downward departure, so I have a 98 sentence that hangs over my head, or 98-month sentence. So I would go back to prison for 98 months if I violated my probation. For 40 years. I'll be 71 when I get off probation for a possession charge. I don't know that I've met any people with violent crimes or any other crimes, to be honest with you, that have that lengthy probation. And I also served jail time, and my daughter was taken. You know, the disparities in sentencing, obviously, there's some issues there, too. But I can tell you from my perspective, there is no reason to have more than 5 years of probation, because if you're not going to change, then you're not going to change. 5 years is plenty of time. I accomplished so much in 5 years. That's it.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for your testimony. We also have Will Cooley signed up to testify.
Okay.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good
Chair Moeller, members of the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee, my name is Will Cooley from the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I'm here to testify on HF 1607, introduced by Representative Jamie Long, capping probation sentences in the state at 5 years. So I don't want to repeat what the testifiers have already talked about, so I'll just give a little bit of overview on the research. Probation is designed to provide offenders the opportunity to stay in the communities, find or keep their jobs, and be directed to social services to help prevent them from recidivism. As part of our work at the MNJRC, we've been speaking to scholars, corrections executives, probation officers, and people on community supervision. This week, I had a probation officer give me an earful for 57 straight minutes on this issue. So we've been listening to folks. We've also been talking to victim advocates across the state. They've got lots of ideas on how to fix the system, but all of them agree that the growth of the state's probation population has overburdened local and state agencies, deteriorating the ability to provide the best returns on our public safety investments, deliver rehabilitation, and establish accountability. Two things are coming up over and over and over in these interviews. Not enough resources in community supervision, and we're not using our current resources in a smart way. A major factor driving the size of the probation population is excessive terms on supervision. As we heard, in Minnesota, people can spend even decades on supervision. And recently, and in your packet, the Libertarian magazine Reason focused on us, this state, right here, calling it the quagmire of criminal justice. So when probation terms are excessive, they can worsen outcomes, create unnecessary encumbrances to successfully completing supervision, and squander precious crime prevention resources. Capping probation terms can reduce the population of people on supervision, which allows for the redirection of energy and attention to the initial months of a term and to focus on individuals at elevated risk. So just quickly, a little bit on the research. Research from across the nation shows that the vast majority of clients could spend less time on supervision without an impact on recidivism. Oregon, a blue state, and South Carolina, a red state, have led the way on research by providing high-quality data. Among people who are on probation for a year without being arrested, more than 90% could spend less time on supervision. These findings demonstrate that by shortening probation terms, we can focus our resources on the people who are being rearrested. So you've heard the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission has already taken action. HF 1607 remedies the holes in what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission could do by making this retroactive. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have Carly Stark signed up to testify. Welcome back to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carly Stark, and today I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, also known as MACAC. We represent 35 counties that provide community supervision under the Community Corrections Act, which is about 70% of the probation population in Minnesota. We support this bill. We supported it back in 2019 and testified at the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We believe in making decisions based on research and evidence, and the research shows that, you know, after a certain amount of time, people are very unlikely to recidivate, and that time is actually, I think, around 3 years, maybe less, so this five-year cap seems reasonable to us. We did some data collection in 2019, and it showed that 84% of cases that were discharged in 2017 and 2018 were less than 5 years, and then less than 10 years, I think, was 92% of cases. So we think that this is being followed through early discharge practices already, and we ask that you support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have anybody else that I'm aware of. Any public testifiers? No? All right. I'm not seeing any, so we can open it up for member discussion. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to speak
up in strong support for this bill. I've been in the weeds with Carly Stark on probation legislation, and I just think this is really important. It's going to allow us to focus resources where they're needed, because we're not keeping people under supervision on probation longer than necessary, in some cases dramatically longer than necessary, to protect public safety. And also, I've heard from a lot of experts about the issues of technical violations. Currently, I believe the last data, it was like $77 million that we spent on people who were incarcerated just due to technical violations. And so limiting probation is just going to alleviate that burden on the system and that injustice. And also, just as Carly Stark said, just we should, and Representative Law, we should follow the data. We should be putting our resources where they are most needed. And I just think this is a really important reform. Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not really a question so much as just some commentary on the bill and the environment in which it's being offered, and the rationale for it. You started off in your presentation citing those statistics about where we rank nationally, sixth lowest incarceration, but sixth highest in terms of probation. And you used an interesting term that caught my attention, and that was the notion that we are by no means a low punishment state. And maybe this is a question. Is that the goal? Is the goal for us to become in Minnesota a low punishment state?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Thank you for the question. So I think that we sometimes, I have heard members say, well, we are not incarcerating very many folks. We're just putting a lot of folks on probation. So the implication is probation isn't that big of a deal. So I wanted to help illuminate that it is a real big deal and that it does have significant impacts on people's lives. I think the goal should be effective punishment, effective sentences for individuals. So I don't know that low or high is necessarily the test. If I were actually following the data specifically, as Ms. Stark said, 3 years is really what the research shows about where probation is the tipping point for where it's effective or not effective. And a lot of other states are moving to a three-year cap. So we're giving a little bit of a buffer here, I think, to, with the 5 years for allowing that there may be some inaccuracies in some of the research, certainly there is no data I'm aware of that shows that after 5 years there's any meaningful effect for probation, depending that essentially you're just as likely to be committing a crime on your 10th year of probation as you are if you don't have probation.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. I very much appreciate that additional context. And, you know, when we talk about where the data leads and what's effective or isn't effective, that the sometimes stated but not always stated premise is that the goal is solely to affect what we call public safety, meaning we want to prevent recidivism, we want to get the person reacclimated and to be a productive member of society again. It's very much focused on the perpetrator and getting them back in the saddle, so to speak. And what seems to be missing from a lot of these conversations is the criminal justice value of punishment. And that's why that phrase caught my attention of low punishment state. And accepting that low or high may not be the critical designation. I think for the folks in my district, for the folks that I know anecdotally, friends, family, folks that I chat with on a day-to-day basis, if I were to ask them, do you want to have a low punishment state to live in? Do you want to be in a state that doesn't punish crime or that punishes it at a low level? I'm pretty sure the answer across the board from almost everybody would be no. I do not want to live in that state where we're not punishing crime. Maybe that's an inherent limitation in the fact that we consider this public safety as opposed to thinking in terms of criminal justice, because justice is about balancing the scales. It's about ensuring that people actually feel the gravity of the offense that they've committed because their victim was punished by their crime. And certainly there are examples of things that we consider crimes that arguably don't have victims, and I'm all about going through and reviewing those and seeing whether or not we're treating those properly. And frankly, I like the idea of limiting the utility of probation, but I'd like to do so in a context where we're not, where the end goal isn't having a low punishment state or a situation where we're just not addressing the punitive value of criminal justice, and we've taken that off the table as a whole. Thank you.
Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Majority Leader Long, for bringing this bill back. I guess with, at the risk of going way too broad here, but my background, my undergrad is in research psychology, and I think that it's important for us to note that the punitive aspects of our criminal justice system are not actually something that deter crime. Crime doesn't happen because, or the lack of crime doesn't happen because people say, oh, like, this is going to be a year of prison but 40 years of probation. Like, nobody's thinking about that when they do something. People, the vast majority of crime is out of desperation, right? I think we can agree that there is a desperation component to the reason why people commit crimes, and not something where a lot of it is premeditated. In fact, the things that are mostly premeditated and crimes that we should be going after, where people are thinking about them, are not actually gone after in the same way. Like, we don't have heavy punishment. We don't have a lot of punitive consequences for people doing white collar crime, you know, where there are like millions and millions of dollars that are stolen from individuals. And in fact, these low level crimes, which could be violent but could also be very nonviolent, as in the example that we are given, are punished in an extreme fashion. And so I guess what I'm saying is, I can see your point, Representative Hudson, that the people in your community are saying that they don't want this to be a low punishment state. But I also think it's upon us as representatives to make sure that people understand that there is science that shows that just because we have it on the books that we can put somebody in probation for 40 years, that's not gonna deter crime. That's not what creates deterrence in this situation. And all it does is create an unjust system where individuals, where certain individuals are punished for 40 years and other people are like given a slap on the wrist and asked to pay a fine that is like 1% of their annual gross income, right? And so really looking at this as something that is not only getting at the punitive aspect of it, but also an equity aspect of it. And when are we asking people to say, like, you have paid the price, and that price is, you know, and we're done, and we want you to reintegrate into society and become full-fledged members of society, I think is really important. And I think that's what this bill gets at. Because 5 years, as we've kept saying, the science behind it says that 3 years is when people are going to, you know, recidivate. And if we wait 5 years and nothing else bad has happened, I think we can pretty succinctly say that they have paid their debt to society for most situations. And if not, then why are you not in prison, right? I mean, like, if it's a murder, then we're like, okay, yeah, 5 years is not long enough. But in most situations where you would be out on probation, we clearly think that you are able to participate in society, and we would like you to participate in society. And because of this, I think a cap on 5 years is really responsible. It's something that I think we should all get behind, and it's something that I think that we can, using science, using the data that we have provided to us in various capacities, I think it's something that we can communicate effectively to our constituents about why it's important to do this. So thank you. It was more of a comment and less of a question, but thank you for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I guess one of my questions would be utilizing the people that are out in the field. If a judge should be allowed to depart from the maximums, let's say there are compelling reasons to do so, would that be allowed? Because obviously they're hearing cases, and my fear is the shotgun approach that we think 5 years is it, but there's always those outliers that raise or lowers. And so having a judge who's hearing a case, can they raise that cap, first of all, is my first question.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you for the question. So not under the current bill, no. And I have three concerns with with going down that road. The first concern, as I mentioned, is that we are seeing real regional disparities in terms of how the sentences are imposed when you have the ability to depart. And that was true before the Sentencing Guidelines Commission acted, such that there are some judicial districts where the bill is almost not needed. There is no sentence imposed over 5 years, and there were some judicial districts where it was consistently imposed over 5 years. So that's one of the reasons why we have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission in general, is to try to have some consistency across region for the state. And unfortunately, we've seen that continue to play out even after the Sentencing Guidelines took action. They were not permitted to not have the ability for judges to depart in the authority that they have. And so they did allow for departures. But we have seen, as I mentioned, where, you know, in 2021, there were zero or one case in one judicial district and 57 cases in another judicial district. The second concern I have is, I think we've talked about the effectiveness of going above 5 years, which I don't think there's a demonstrated case for. And so I think as a policymaking body, we can let our partners in the judicial branch know what our policy position is on going above that. And then the third concern I have is that for some of the departures we've seen, they have gone up to that real extreme level. So there have been several that were 20-year departures for probation terms. And I just don't think, you know, we don't really have a, you know, maybe you could make an argument on the margins, but when you're getting to 20 years, there's no real case I can see to be made for something like that.
Representative Woody.
Thank you for that. I understand the 20 years in that. I'm just looking at that five and going up a little bit. I did ask someone that's a probation officer right now, and asked them, and they said the set parameters. So if they're doing well, yeah, cap it at the 5 year. But also if they're not, it holds them a little bit closer. So if there would be a way to kind of give our probation officers out in the field that tool, that there could be a hearing that raises it if they feel the need to do or something, I think would be helpful just from them doing their job out there instead of them knowing, hey, I gotta do what I have to do for 5 years and then I'm gone, you know. Just a thought.
Ms. Schroeder, did you want to comment? I couldn't tell quite if you were. Yeah, come back up to the microphone here.
I was just wanted to speak on that, on what you're talking about, because so probation officers, and this is coming from somebody who's been on probation, can be biased in situations where, and this you're seeing a lot in the black community, unfortunately, will violate people on things that aren't even big violations. So like giving the probation officer the power to extend a period of probation can be bad too, because there's a lot of people that are getting violations that don't deserve violations from probation officers, and that's just the truth. That in my case, fortunately, I had a very great probation officer. You know, she was at my college graduation. She's awesome. But this is different from Hennepin County and Ramsey County, where you see a lot of times people getting violated for no reason. So if given the power to extend it, I mean, I just think that 5 years is such a 5 years. You can accomplish so much in 5 years. And if you're not wanting to change and you're violating, then, like she said, you should probably be in jail then. Honestly, I mean, that's just what I have to say. Thank you.
Yep. Let's see. Representative Curran and then Novotny, and we'll close it up. We do have testifiers here for the next bill, too. Go ahead, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Leader Long, for this bill. And I just wanted to make a couple of comments first on, you know, if we're looking at, you know, if Minnesota, you know, how we handle crime and how we deal with recidivism and all that. And I think I really like the way that you described it as we're not a low punishment, we're not high punishment, and that certainly shouldn't be goals. I share that belief. I think we should be effective. And what I'm hearing is that after 5 years, probation just is no longer effective. And I think part of the concern that all of us share is having folks who commit acts of violence against other people. You know, are we making sure that that's not happening again? So I guess my question for you is, When we have acts of violence, you know, when we're limiting probation to 5 years, does that have any effect at all on the incarceration sentence that somebody might have for committing acts of violence against one?
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thanks for the question. So I will note that we exclude homicide and criminal sexual conduct as the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission did. So those crimes are excluded and can have longer than 5-year probation terms. In terms of other acts of violence, so the research doesn't really distinguish that there are certain types of crimes where probation certainly suddenly becomes effective after 5 years versus other types of crimes. So I do think it will be taken into account certainly on a prospective basis when you're looking at the sentence, I would imagine, for some cases. But I think even when we're thinking retroactively for where there were certain sentences that were imposed that were above 5-year probation, you know, I can understand why there has been some hesitation in the past around retroactivity there. But I would just posit that when we have so much data at this point showing that there is no benefit for having a probation term beyond 5 years, I don't think there's a good argument for allowing that to continue even retroactively.
Thank you. All right, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Just want to push back on a couple of things. Being on the Community Corrections Task Force last summer, I understand it's very expensive to run the program, and it is a program that is stretched, and I would like to see the resources focused on the people that need the most supervision to get them back on the path that they need. And it's been touched on a couple times, but Representative Long, you said, you know, people are saying that we're a low incarceration state. We're not saying we're a low incarceration state. We are, in fact, a low incarceration state. We're, depending on the year and what matrix you use, at least in the low five. So it's not that we're saying it. It's true. To the testifier, I would argue absolutely 40 years is too long. And I don't know, without the background of your case, how long it's been, but what's that?
10. I'm on 10.
10. Years. By your own admission, it seems to work, though. And I don't want to pull any information out of it that you don't want to give, but I believe there was probably a plea deal involved in that sentence.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Schroeder.
There was not. I got a downward departure. I left it in the judge's hands. There was no plea deal. I pled guilty, and the judge sentenced me freely. There was a downward departure, so there was no plea deal.
Going on to what the county attorney has questions about this too, and Majority Leader Long, I hope you address those issues. I agree with them. They have concerns, as do I, about the retroactivity, going back and automatically looking at changing law, revisionist history. They'd like to see a public process for this, and so would I. I just feel that at a minimum we should bring the public into this. Don't see a process for victim notification if they will even be involved in this. I hope before this comes to the floor that those are addressed. I think they're valid concerns that we should bring it in. Thank you for putting the exemptions for criminal sexual assault. That is the one thing that I absolutely think that there must be, because I can tell you from many cases that I involved that is something, especially when it involves criminal sexual assault on minors, that is something that should be absolutely in thing. But there's other cases, as the County Attorneys Association points out, that they should be having the ability to do an upward departure on that, you know, given the substantial and compelling reasons. So I think that not having any mechanism is also not good for justice overall, and I hope that you look at amending that before it comes to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Vaughn.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I appreciate the comments, Representative Vaughn. I didn't hear Ms. Schroeder say that the 40-year probation term was what got her back on track. I think she said that having the opportunity to work with an excellent probation worker got her back on track and within a five-year timeline. I will just mention, I really appreciate Ms. Schroeder coming up here for many years to share her story and a real success story, graduating with a 4.0, being out there giving back and doing addiction recovery support. It's just extremely impressive, and it sounded like there was unanimous agreement that the situation Ms. Schroeder is facing is incredibly unjust, and she's not the only one. I've met with many others who have extremely long probation terms. As I mentioned, there, even after the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we're still seeing 20-year probation sentences. So I do think this is necessary, and I just thank the members here for hearing the bill today and look forward to continued conversation.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1607 as amended. Thank you again to our testifiers. We really appreciate it. And last but not least is a bill for victims, House File 1279. Wow. It is a Representative Adelson. another bill for victims. Yeah. I couldn't resist. Lee Novotny. So we've got House File 1279, Representative Adelson. Since you're no longer on the committee, Representative Adelson, I will move to lay over House File 1279. And I believe that you do have an A2 amendment. If you could explain your A2 amendment to us, please.
I do, Madam Chair. It makes technical changes that update the statute based on things that we found, and then the amendment offers clarifying changes such as on 0.2.29 and 2.30. It does a cap of $1,400 for the cost.
Great. Any discussion to the A2 amendment?
Chair Moeller.
Representative Novotny.
Will this be going back to health then with the amendment?
We are laying this over.
It has to go to health.
Yeah, we're going to lay it over for now, but we'll talk about that. Yep. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Adelson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 1279, I just want to make sure that the committee knows, all the people that worked on this. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association, which is right here, Office of Justice Programs, Minnesota Hospital Association, SANES, and also coordinators, the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners, Minnesota Department of Health, and the Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Sexual violence impacts every community and affects people of all ages, genders, sexual orientations, excuse me, and often has lasting impacts on health and well-being. Sexual violence has been classified as a serious public health issue by the World Health Organization and the CDC. In the U.S., more than 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men experience sexual violence in their lifetime. House File 1279, as amended, does two things. It creates a statewide administered fund to pay for the health care system for the medical forensic examiners they provide to sexual assault victims. Currently, payment for sexual assault exams in the state is the responsibility of the county where the sexual assault takes place. The county payer system has resulted in several different challenges for the healthcare systems, county administrators, and victim survivors. A state administrator fund will clarify existing confusion on a variety of fronts. Payments will be uniform so hospitals can effectively budget and have confidence regarding how to receive payment for the services they have provided. The counties will no longer have to determine how much to budget for sexual assault exams, resulting in increased administrative efficiency. Finally, victim survivors can be assured with confidence that exactly what will be paid by the state fund. The state fund approach will help ensure that victim survivors are not billed in error or surprised by a bill refused by a county payer. House File 1279 will accomplish great efficiency and equity for counties, hospitals, and victim survivors across the state. I would like to note that about 17 other states across the U.S. have a state fund like this. The second area the bill does is it clarifies best practices for medical examinations. It ensures that victims of sexual assault in our state receive the best care and interventions. The bill also ensures that evidence is collected at these exams and is tested in a timely manner. Criminal investigations can move more quickly, and victims can experience the closure of knowing that their kit has been tested to completion. All of these important changes with the bill today promote efficiency and equity for victim survivors, hospitals, and our 87 counties throughout the state. Madam Chair, I have two testifiers, and I would like to move to them.
First testifier is Sheriff Brian Cruz. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, members of the community or committee. I'm Meeker County Sheriff Brian Cruz, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to show support for House File 1279. First and foremost, I want to be clear that the sheriffs of Minnesota are fully committed to victim survivors receiving sexual assault exams without delay and without cost. And to me, this bill strengthens our ability to ensure that happens without exception. With the current system, billing goes back to the county of occurrence. This includes exams that are both restricted and unrestricted. We see a wide range of services and costs that range anywhere from $400 to $11,000. I have a bill that I'm still negotiating the price on that started at $6,000 from a year ago. A county smaller than mine very recently within the last 2 weeks received that $11,000 bill that I mentioned. We have some hospitals that have contracts with their local law enforcement. But if the exam is for someone from another jurisdiction, those hospitals are not honoring that local agreement with that jurisdiction for the other jurisdiction. When my hospital had a sane examiner, we never saw a bill over $800, and a lot of times we saw bills in the $400 to $600 range. With the wide range of billing, we are also seeing a wide range of services, and that's by looking at those bills that we receive. In my opinion, consistency is lacking from a billing perspective. As I said, we're committed to the victim survivors receiving those exams at no cost, but the reality is we don't have the budgets that can sustain these costs and the huge increases that we're seeing as of late. So a local budget, that is a major implication and could mean something somewhere else gets cut because we know that these have to be paid. The bill also helps strengthen victim survivor confidentiality. In smaller agencies, the likelihood of a victim knowing someone in the financial side of the county, seeing the billing for services is actually pretty good. We don't want a victim to be apprehensive about an exam because they know their neighbor, friend, or family member works in the county. Pulling the billing out of the county and sending to a state agency just adds to that confidentiality. That is very important for our victim survivors. Having these services streamlined and administered by one agency statewide with a cap on costs helps ensure consistency and the cost of the exams don't become an issue. It also strengthens the privacy rights of our victims. Thank you for your time this morning. And again, from me personally, on behalf of the 87 sheriffs that represent the Sheriff's Association, we are in support of House File 1279.
Thank you, Sheriff. Looks like next up is M. Westerlin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is M. Westerlin, and I work at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, MNCASA. Which is what that stands for, is a statewide membership coalition and collective voice of organizations and individuals committed to ending sexual violence. I'm the statewide medical forensic policy program coordinator at the coalition, and it is my job to know what is happening throughout the state regarding medical forensic exams for sexual assault survivors. The fact is, the issues in our current exam payment approach have been known for over a decade, and systems professionals have been trying to develop solutions for just as long. House File 1279 is the culmination of our collective effort to improve the system for sexual assault nurse examiners, hospitals, law enforcement, county payors, and most critically, victim survivors. Currently, Minnesota is one of only six states in the nation that uses a county payer model. With 87 different county payors, all located in different county departments, many issues arise. Shifts in staffing, budgetary constraints, and confusion about obligations are all challenges that can result in inconsistent or disparate payments for hospitals and clinics. Unfortunately, our county-by-county approach to exam payment is not working. The clarification of best practices for medical forensic exams shifts Minnesota from a testing model for sexually transmitted infections to a proactive treatment model. This is in line with guidelines issued by the Centers for Disease Control and reflects best practice in forensic medicine. Perhaps most critically, House File 1279 will help to ensure that victim survivors of sexual assault receive high-quality, trauma-informed services. The creation of a state fund will help ensure equity in billing and payment across jurisdictions and reduce the likelihood that a victim survivor may inadvertently be billed for their medical forensic exam. Minnesota has made great strides over the past several years to ensure that our state policies for sexual assault victims reflect national best practices. House File 1279 is another important step toward ensuring that victim survivors of sexual assault in our state receive the best possible services at every step of their journey toward healing and justice. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify? I am not seeing any. And before we move to member discussion, I thank you, Representative Novotny, for bringing up the amendment and how it impacts the stop. So I'm going to change my original motion to lay over House File 1279 and instead re-refer House File 1279 as amended to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All right, member discussion. Not seeing any. It's good to be the last one right before lunch. Everybody's ready. You had to wait a long time, but
I'm not going
to
take it personal.
And it's a good bill too. So please, with your closing comments, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and it's good to see you all. I just want to clarify, I did misspoke. So it was 17 states that actually have a cap on the amount they charge. It's about 34 states that actually have a state fund sort of mechanism that we're doing here today. So I just want to make sure that members know states, there was Georgia, Nevada, Texas, Pennsylvania, all limit the cap at 1,000. We're doing 1,400 to try to go above the MA base so that we're not going to have issues. We will have an amendment to make sure none of these costs go to survivors, and thank you everybody for your support.
Yeah, thanks. And I forgot to mention the A1 amendment was in the packet, but it was my understanding that it was withdrawn in light of the A2 amendment, so I'm getting some head nods on that. And so now, and hopefully I'm going to do this right because of the change in the motion, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 1279 as amended to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you so much, everybody. With that, we are adjourned.